is Monday at 5:30 here on Say Hey, Chico's only locally produced sports talk radio program. My name is Jake, and I am back from a five-week absence. I was abroad. I was in Europe playing music for 5 weeks, and now I'm back in Chico, and it feels great. Had a wonderful trip, and there's a lot to tell. But I'll save some of that music stuff for my music programming. So we will stick to sports today. Back on Say Hey. Thank you to Jarreau. Thank you to Noobs. Thank you to, I'm sure, Derek, who I bet pitched in. Really appreciate covering me while I'm out. And now I'm back. So looking forward to bringing you the latest and greatest. And we're going to have a bit of a tribute here on the show today. But we'll start, before we pay tribute to Muhammad Ali, which we're going to do the bulk of for the rest of the program, we will at least go with a little bit of, you know, game news, first of which is the Warriors are up 2-0 on the Cavs. If you watched last night, it's pretty much no contest thus far. The Cavaliers are being blown out of the series in a fashion that doesn't really happen. Largest margin of victory for the first two games of an NBA Finals ever, I believe. They won last night, the Warriors did, by 33. I was at game one, which is where the bench took over and blew them out. I don't want to say the series is over, because that would be getting ahead of myself a bit. But right now, after two games, it's about as close to over as it can get. When you look at the way the Warriors are dominating every facet of the game, have now defeated the Cavaliers in seven straight games. It's not as if they're just having a bad run. You consider that the Cavs were red hot coming into the series. It's about as close to over as it gets two games in. That doesn't mean the Cavs won't win on Wednesday night and make it a series at 2-1 at least, but not looking good if you're a Cavs fan. And then on the Sharks side, hockey, big win the other night. Sharks take game three, stay in the series. Pittsburgh still up 2-1. Game four is going on in San Jose right now as we speak. And Jonas Donskoy was the hero in overtime the other night. That was a really, really good game. My buddy Kyle was there. And Jonas Donskoy gets it done in overtime to give the Sharks their first ever Stanley Cup final victory. And I want to play, since he is Finnish, the Finnish broadcast of Jonas Donskoy's goal in Game 3 of the Stanley Cup Finals. Here's how it sounded in Finland.
Tässä hyökkäyksessä Donskoy. Tieni. Donskoy tulee läpi kiekon kanssa. Donskoy laukaa. Se tekee maalin! Jonas Donskoy! Sharks voittaa! Suomalainen tekee ratkaisua suman! Jonas Donskoy on sankari numero yksi!
That was the call from Finland on Jonas Donskoy's game winner for Game 3. Very exciting stuff. Like I said, that game is going on right now. It's on NBC. They are about 7 minutes into the first period. That's still in San Jose. And then, as we mentioned, the next game for the Cavs-Warriors is in Cleveland. That's on Wednesday. Game 4 on Friday. So be sure and tune in if you are a fan of the NBA. Regardless of the blowouts, it's still very exciting. Now, kind of get through that real quick. Normally, we'd probably talk about the finals all the way through, but Muhammad Ali passed away this weekend, as I'm sure most of you know. He's more than just a sporting icon. Muhammad Ali was just a massive figure, period. One of the most well-known individuals of the last 100 years in any walk of life. All around the world, not just being the greatest heavyweight boxer of all time, but a leader in civil rights. You can't say enough about Muhammad Ali. And I was, despite the fact that, you know, he's had Parkinson's since 1981 or 84 when he announced that he had Parkinson's, he's been unable to speak for a lot of that time in any way publicly. But his impact, even though I wasn't alive when he was doing his thing, it didn't really matter. He was one of my dad's heroes, for example. And I grew up watching Ali fights and watching his speeches. And I don't know, he was really special to me and to many, many more people, millions and millions and millions of people. And I was deeply saddened when he passed away, even though he hadn't been himself in 30-some-odd years. But I don't know, just thinking about it makes me kind of sad. But you have to celebrate his life, and there's going to be a massive public service in his hometown of Louisville on Friday, I believe. And I'll look forward to seeing that, as it will most certainly be broadcast. But this program, the rest of it, we will pay tribute to Muhammad Ali with a couple of different interviews. We'll start off with one, the political side of Muhammad Ali, the side of him that touched people far more than a sport ever could. And, of course, he chose not to accept being drafted into the Vietnam War at the height of his boxing ability, you might say, despite the fact that he came back to be the champion once again. He was stripped of the title when he made this decision, and he was a young man, and he didn't care. He gave it all up for 3.5 years because he was not going to the Vietnam War. And this was a speech that he gave in the late 60s on why he was not going to Vietnam or what it meant to him. So have a listen to Muhammad Ali talking about the Vietnam War.
First of all, I would like to thank the student governing body for inviting me here to speak at this beautiful and worthy occasion tonight. And I would also like to congratulate them on their great, splendid stand to stop the bloody war that's now going on in Vietnam. And as a Muslim minister, my own outlook on war and violence is well known by now. And I would like to say that the number one greeting in my faith is peace, and that is As-salamu alaykum, which means may peace be unto you. There have been many questions put to me why I refuse to be inducted into the United States Army, especially as some have pointed out, many have pointed out, when not taking the step, I will lose so much. And I would like to say to those of the press and those of the people who think that I lost so much by not taking the step, I would like to say that I did not lose a thing up until this very moment. I haven't lost one thing. I have gained a lot. Number one, I have gained a peace of mind. I have gained a peace of heart. I now know that I'm in content with Almighty God Himself, whose proper name is Allah. I have also gained the respect of everyone here today. I have not only gained the respect of everyone here today, but worldwide I have gained respect. People all over the world and by taking the step may have satisfied a few people who are pushing the war. Even if the wealth of America was given to me for taking the step, the wealth of America and the friendship of all of the people who support the war, this will still be nothing if I am not content internally and if I'm not in accord with the will of Almighty Allah. As you read the newspapers and the press now, you see that I am now in court. I am in court seeking justice under the laws of the land. In this country, the United States of America, ministers are exempt from the armed services. And if they choose, I am a Muslim minister and a teacher of the religion of Islam. It has been said that I have two alternatives. Either go to jail or go to the army. But I would like to say that there is another alternative. And that alternative is justice. And if justice prevails, I will neither go to the army nor will I go to jail. They say that actually every time that I enter the ring, in a way, I'm going to war. They say to me daily, "You are a prize fighter. What's the difference?" And I like to say to those critics of the press and to the others that there is one hell of a lot of difference in fighting in the rain and going to war in Vietnam. Boxing is nothing like going to war with machine guns, bazookas, hand grenades, bomber airplanes. My intention is to box to win a clean fight, but in war, the intention is to kill, 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 and continue killing innocent people. That's what the business is war. I would like to hear this from you, and I want the world and the cameras to hear. Who's the heavyweight champion of the world? And I'm very pleased and thankful for being here. And that's all I would like to say. Thank you very much.
It was Muhammad Ali in the late 60s speaking as to why he was not going to war. He lost 3.5 years of his career, as we mentioned, at the height of his ability. But he still came back after all that and became the champ once again, defeating George Foreman. Let's have an interview now that's kind of the lighter side of Ali. Another thing that made him the man that he was, the engaging, trash-talking, just lovable character that kind of, I don't know, he was just a magnet. It's hard not to smile when you watch Muhammad Ali interviews where he's putting on a show. And this is one actually done in the UK after the George Foreman fight, a couple of years, I believe. And we'll go with this one right on out to the end of the show. Once again, a tribute to Muhammad Ali. It's only a half hour, but best we can do. So have a listen to the lighter side of Ali here in this interview with in the UK.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I introduce the heavyweight champion of the world, indeed of planet Earth, Muhammad Ali. As you see, Muhammad, we've gathered a few of our friends, and I think friends of yours, here this afternoon.
They're going to be asking you. I see one fellow out there.
Did you get an eight on the jaw when you see him?
My friend, he knocked me down once.
We're going to come to that in a second. A lot of these guys have followed you all over the world, writing about your fights. We've got one or two people from the show business world here, mm-hmm. and we've got some ladies too who are in the business of journalism. They're going to ask you questions soon, but can I start by asking you a few questions? I want to say first how much of a pleasure it is to see you back in London. And I know that you've said in the past that you regard Britain as your second home. Why is that?
Well, when I say that, I really mean sports-wise, because in many cases, you can say Britain can be ranked as number one as far as supporting me is concerned. I know the boxing authorities and the people, when Joe Frazier was recognized as champion, and this Jimmy Ellis, and the little hassles that I had there in the States, they just didn't pay no attention to me, and they recognized me as their champion, you know, people, and called me the people's champion, and I had got a lot of support from here during the days of my Prussian. That's why I always say that about England.
Do you regard them as your strongest fans in many ways?
Well, you really can't say who's the strongest fans because I'm not the people. I don't know how certain people take it. One fan was so strong he got killed after a few my fight with Frazier, the second fight, arguing over idea. And so we really can't say who's much stronger than a man who's dead if he's still living. But I would say that it's real debatable. Well, a lot of real fans here.
I know you went up to Lancashire one occasion, didn't you? And you had a lot of strong fans there. Oh, a lot of ladies who gave you a bit of a tough time, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Tell us about it.
Well, we went up to a supermarket there, and thousands and thousands of people. This was Birmingham and Manchester, and I just never saw so many people in one crowd, and they were crushing each other and jumping out in front of the cars and could have got hurt, and this is why I know they're sincere.
Are you scared when you see that kind of thing?
Well, it frightens you, not because of my welfare, but you hate to see people, you know, crowding the stage, trying to get autographs, and you see somebody being squeezed, they're suffering in the crowd because too many people are behind them, and this worries you. Or somebody sticking their arm in a moving car and getting caught, and these type things, falling in front of a car when we're in big crowds. We just left Zaire. I went back for a week, and we had about 300,000 people lined up from the airport in big crowds just all through the streets, and the drivers were like racing and excited, and little children and people falling, you know, under the front wheel of the car or in front of the car, and they were stopped just in time, and it would just kill me if, because of me and people admiring me, I look back and see somebody bleeding or squares half to death because they got caught in a crowd, and I feel guilty, you know, so this worries me.
You've mentioned Zaire, you've mentioned this country, and of course you've mentioned your own country. Where do you think you are at your happiest, and in what kind of company?
When I met my happiest was always when I'm in Chicago with my three little girls and my boy and my wife in my mobile home somewhere on the highway eating hamburgers, no press or nobody around.
Yeah, right. You said that those three girls of yours are really quite dangerous, aren't they?
Yeah, they...
What do you mean when you say that?
Dangerous because they're pretty. And when they get to be about, I imagine, 18 and 19, I'm going to be in trouble. Some fella told me the reason you have three girls and one boy is because you're going to be paid back for all the wrong you've done. Lord.
But don't you think those kids, great kids that they are going to have a problem when they grow up because their father was the greatest of all time?
Well, I think it can present not a serious problem, but wherever you go, people will point to you and say this or that. But if you keep quiet and don't publicize it, I'm sure that people really won't know who you are. And Joe Lewis's daughter was about... was handling some job or core thing in Chicago, and didn't nobody know it was his daughter until she really told somebody, you know. If you just keep it quiet,
the way they handle themselves, right. Really. Yeah. What did your mother want for you when you were a young lad, Muhammad?
She just wanted me to, like all mothers basically, to go to school, to get education, to stay out of trouble, stay out of bad gangs, and try to be somebody in life. That's all.
When did you know that you were the greatest?
When did I know I was the greatest?
Yeah.
You see, I was born in 1942. No, when I was 12 years old, I figured I had a great chance of being a fighter.
Yeah.
When I was 12.
You've had so many high spots in your career, in your life, I know that, and a lot of people think that your life is a very glamorous one, and you may think that's true too, but there must have been bad moments in your career and in your life, Muhammad. Can you recall any?
Well, you know, the first Frazier fight, you know, I was off 3.5 years. That was bad. And over here, oh, a terrible moment in my life. Ooh, is when I 1963, when that Henry Cooper hit me. He hit me with a left hook. That lick was so hard, it jarred my color friends in America.
Henry, let me bring you in on this one, because, in fact, if that bell hadn't sounded, do you think you could have nailed Muhammad in that round?
Oh, definitely, yeah. Definitely. He was gone.
I'll tell you what,
he
was Henry, gone. Come up. Can we have an action replay?
You're trying to start
some trouble. I just want to know how it happened, actually.
Really?
Come on.
I'll come go the right way now.
Henry still looks good, too. He don't have no fat on or nothing.
Show us how the
I'll show you what I was doing. I was in the corner. Come
on,
Henry.
He was going backwards from me.
Yeah, I was in the corner, jabbing. Hey. Well, he's one of the good.
And that was it?
Yeah, man. Fast. He hit me so fast, he hit me before God got the news.
Where's your great gun?
Come and sit down, Muhammad. Yeah. Good to have you, Henry. I know we have another fighter.
Henry looks
here.
Like he can still fight,
so
if
like
he wanted to.
I'd like to introduce to you, if I may, Muhammad. His name is Len Harvey. He's one of the greatest British champions. He was a British champion at three different weights, middle, light, heavy, and heavy, in the 1930s and the early 40s. He fought at every single weight. Can I ask you, Len, would you have fancied your chances in the same ring as Muhammad Ali?
Well, sure, yeah.
I thought I was the only cockiest fighter.
But let me ask you this. Would you prefer to fight the Muhammad Ali of the 1964s when Henry fought him, or the 1974 Muhammad Ali?
I think, to be fair to myself, that I would take the 64, yes.
You think you'd have had an easier task if you could have had an easier task
I
at all?
I think that I'm a... won a lot of, you know, a lot of fights after that, and he began to get good just when it's time for him to, you know, back up.
I see. Rick, I know that you've got to, you
he
wanted
me
then?
When I was at my fastest, right?
Right.
He must have been fast.
He was very fast. Yeah. Rich, come in. I know there's a question that you want to put on at this point.
Yes. I think Len could hold as good as you, Muhammad, which would have been very worrying. Now, you're a boxing student, and I wouldn't want to take you on in that field. But having said that,
I'm a student.
Oh yes, you say you're a student, and you're an expert. This is why you're world
professor.
Exactly. I bow to your superior knowledge at all times. You know that. Would the 1964 then Cassius Clay have beaten the present Muhammad Ali, one with the style and the speed, and now the one with the weight and the strategy? How would you have fought yourself then?
Well, they, you know, like, people really, they this is why they underestimated me. They forgot about what I can do. You know, they got blind. They talk about weight. I went in there fighting George Wendt about 213 pounds. And this was 1 pound heavier than Sonny Liston when I was hot in my prime. I wasn't heavy. I don't know why they keep saying weight. And I would say that the moving and the dancing, I could still do that, man. Yeah, I didn't want to do that because I would have gotten too tired at the pace. I danced about one round. The first round, I kind of moved. And I was a little too tired for one round. And figuring out I had 14 more rounds to go, this pace I couldn't keep up. And I had to move 3 or 4 steps to his one because he was cutting the ring off pretty good. I was surprised he could corner me like he could. So if I'd kept that pace up and dancing for 7 or 8 rounds, I would have had to resort to ropes and actual exhaustion and tiredness. And then probably he would have got one through. So I said, I'm going to lay on the ropes first and let him throw all the punches. And if he don't have nothing too dangerous, then I'll stay on the ropes until he tire out. And that's what he did. But that type style, fighting as you say, Cassius Clay, 64, would have won easy, the 64 style, because I would have moved, I would have kept moving, and laying on the ropes wouldn't have bothered me like it did George, because if a man lays on the ropes, I'll just jab in and back off of him, and I'll tag him, and if I'm really hitting him, I'll keep hitting him. But if I'm not landing, see, George didn't have enough sense to realize he was not landing. He just kept throwing and throwing and throwing, ran out of gas, or what you all call it, petrol, and there wasn't a station around nowhere, do you feel? See? So the first Cassius Clay doing the hopping and jumping would have beat that man on the rope style, because I never would have came in hitting range. I stayed off.
When did you decide on those tactics? Before the fight,
no,
sir, Muhammad?
No, sir, it's like, you know, I'm sure Henry will tell you, any fighter that knows what's happening, you really can't plan a fight when you're meeting a man you've never met before, right? You just have to get your tools ready. Here's a car stops on the highway. They call the AAA or whatever and say, my car's broke down. What it is, the lady, she don't know it's broke. Well, the man comes with all the tools, and he come equipped to handle whatever the problem is. An astronaut goes into space, and he pretends that something happens to the ship before he take off. He gets out and he works on it. He's not looking for something to happen, but it might happen. So I just had everything ready. Now, after the first round, being here with a top professional, a man so great, had so many knockouts, never been defeated, never been even scratched, I didn't know really how good he was. So I had to come in, actually a little nervous, and with everything ready. After one round of dancing, I found out that this would tire me out. So I would have to resort to ropes. I figured that out after the first round. So I said, I'm going to go to these ropes, and I'm going to let this man throw everything he can. Let him tire himself out. He might look like he's winning. And if he don't hurt me, I'm going to stay here. But if he should be as great as they say he is, if he hits as hard as they say he hit, when he hits you and breaks your arm, he knocked out Joe Frazier. I couldn't do it. Knocked out Ken Norton. He was a big, bad jab before the fight, you remember. Now, you remember that, don't you?
Yeah,
how bad he was? They don't say that now. But you remember he was a real bad cat the other day, right? Don't forget that. Now, after I found out he didn't have it, I stayed there. But if he had had what I thought he had had or what they said he had, I'd have kept running, hoping I wouldn't get tired.
Ken, you want to come back, I think, on
yeah,
that, don't
just
you?
A point, Muhammad, when we spoke about 4 hours after the fight in the bungalow in Insali, you said that you'd suspected before the fight that that the man didn't like being hurt. Now, I know no one likes being hurt, but this had registered with you.
He don't like even being hit. I mean, see, you must realize this. Here's what I told the press. I told you all everything just about what happened. I said, the man is a little too slow. The man is, though he has no class. The man throws a whole lot of wild punches when he's not tired. And once he's tired, he's going to be falling all over everybody, like I told you. I told you that the man is never really being hit hard. And after he hears the man say, round four, round five. He's only heard the man say round three in the last 5 or 6 years at the most. Round six. Round seven. Round eight. He said, what's happening? You understand? Now, to have a man, I told you, constantly hitting him, I was telling you. I was trying, he constantly feel that. This is going to frustrate him. You understand? And to have a man that he can't knock out real quick. I said, this man has never been experienced. Joe Frazier was a little fat that night, got hit with some freak punch, and he never had a chance to show what he could do, and Fulman didn't have a chance to really show us what he could do. Norton got hit too quick to really see what he could do after he got tired and winded. Joe King Roman, and that's all he had was Frazier, Norton and Roman, and all of a sudden he's one of the greatest of all times. I said, you all are wrong. This man is nothing. I'm the greatest of all times. Are you crazy? This will be no match. The kid's, he's a kid. Wasn't I right?
Muhammad, I know that Reg has got a point to make about the way that you fought that fight and the kind of problems that referees might have with the way you tactics you adopted there.
Yeah, there are some European referees, Muhammad, who say you're wrestling and hanging on a bit too much, or razzling, as you say with the States. Would you be worried with a European referee at the threat of disqualification if you were holding on too much?
Yes, I'd be worried, but what I do see is that like a man like Joe Frazier, George Foreman, when they come at me with all that force and they miss, they fall in my chest. And then I like rest my hand on them to hold them there so they won't do nothing in close.
Right.
Now, and I kind of hold him. I'm holding him. And he's trying to get loose. And that's tiring him, you understand? After 6 or 7 rounds, you're tired, right, Henry? That tires you out when the man is holding you trying to fight against him.
Oh, no.
I wish this fellow was still fighting. I don't like what he said.
You didn't hold on to Cooper at all. You didn't have a chance to hold on to him.
No,
he took a second fight.
He did?
He was like going in the fight.
I tell you
with
something, you all
second.
Can't feel.
Well,
you can see the holding, but you can't really feel how I'm holding him, see? And I really be holding him. Yeah, I hold him.
Muhammad, can I ask you, you're carrying that stick all the time now. What is the significance?
No, I just like it. It's nothing. Just a little cane I picked up in Zaire. I might not have it tomorrow or nothing. No,
it's not bad.
Go to bed.
I want to bring in Alan Hubbard at this point because I know you've got a boxing question to ask Muhammad Alan.
Right, Dickie. Mohammed, as you know, the readers of my magazine have voted you the personality of the decade. We know that you're the greatest. We're not going to argue with that. But how do you prove you're the greatest? If you could pick any heavyweight champion in history, say from my...